Welcome to Write Through the Roof, the podcast for writers who want to improve their craft. I'm Madeline Diest, and in this show, I'm interviewing writers of all different types and asking, what's that one thing that took your writing to the next level? So come and join me and learn all the proven tips, tricks, and techniques to take your writing right through the roof. Before we get into this week's interview, just a little bit of a warning. There are a few Skype outs and technical issues during the recording, but please stick with me. It's a really good, fun conversation with Charles Christian. And secondly, there's something I'd like to ask from you. As a Write Through the Roof listener, I'd like to hear what kinds of writers you'd like me to interview. So hit me up on Twitter or put a comment in the show notes on madelinediest.com and let me know what type of genre writers you'd like to hear from. So look forward to hearing from you. Welcome to Right Through the Roof, and today I'm speaking with Charles Christian. Hi Charles, how's it going?
It's going fine, thank you.
That's great. A little introduction about Charles. So Charles is a former barrister, a Reuters correspondent, award-winning tech journalist, best-selling non-fiction writer, podcaster, radio host, and werewolf hunter. So thanks for sparing the time today to speak with me.
That's fine. There isn't a full moon, so I'm not busy werewolf hunting.
It's pretty close, though.
It is.
Okay, so how I like to start off is some warm-up questions. So, you know, like a little kind of aperitif before we get into it. So you write lots of different things. So you write...
Yeah. I do indeed.
So what is your favourite type of writing?
I suppose it is short to mid. I spent most of my life as a journalist writing basically anything I was briefed to do, and I've always tended to go for short form rather than long. I'm struggling with a novel, but I quite like the novella length, in a way. You're not quite a short story, longer than a short story, but shorter than a novel. I've recently been one of the judges on the Arthur C. Clarke Award for science fiction novels, and that involved reading hundreds, literally hundreds, of enormous 1,000-pager novels, some of which turned out to be only part one of a four-part trilogy, and no irony spotted by the authors there. And you look at a lot of them and you think, really, a good editor could have cut this down to 30,000 words. You know, there's so much stuff we don't need in there. And, you know, we tend to forget that not that long ago, most novels, as in paperbacks, were coming in at 30 to 40,000 words. And we've just only relatively recently, in writing terms, that we've started to go for these huge doorstop type books. And so I think the smaller novella length is my favorite. I think it also goes better for e-books. It's a more easy to consume, a more popular size. Unfortunately, it's completely hated by publishers for print. You're never going to get your novella published, but there we go.
Yeah, it's actually been quite a popular answer from my guests about people liking that novella length.
All right. Yeah, what for all different sorts of genre?
Yeah, so I had Gail Carriger on a couple of weeks ago, and she said it was her favourite as well. And what I said to her as well is that what I've noticed is going, as you just said, going back, you know, historically, it's some of these classics where you go, they're actually not that long.
Yeah, I mean, I read a lot of science fiction, and I've got new books, and then I've got some old paperbacks from way back, and the paperbacks are tiny by comparison, and it's same thickness paper, same print size and everything else, just people didn't write so prolix, you know, prolifically as they do now. But I suspect there's an element of the publishers pushing them there, that the economics of print book publishing, it makes sense to go for bigger rather than smaller.
But surely when you're getting to your 1,000 pages, you know, that's starting to tip over the edge there.
Well, it is tip over the bookshelves as well, but... Yeah, no, I don't get it. You know, you read it and you read it all the way through and you think, you could have said this in half the time.
You know? Cut out all those songs.
Yes. Yay.
So do you write...
The basics.
Yeah, do you write every day?
I do, but it's not necessarily sort of creative writing. It's other writing, you know, blogging, scripts for the podcast, because we script it rather than sit there and hope something will happen, because the podcast is a magazine format, so we organise that. So one form or another, I do write every day, and have been doing so for a long, long, long time, say back in the days when I used to be a freelance journalist. And if any of you are out there are freelancers, you know that the money is to write as much as possible, because the more outlets to get you, more the more money you get in. And so I used to be, you know, have word processor will travel or will meet deadlines.
So that's a good training ground, of course, to just get stuck into it.
Yeah, it is, because you start out and you think, ooh, I'd like to write about this subject. But of course, in journalism, that you rarely have the luxury of deciding what you want to write about. It's getting in with an editor who says, can you write about X? And even though you know nothing about it, say, yes, I can, when do you want it by? And you go out and research it and do it. And I think it falls over a bit the same with creative writing, you know, just sitting there in front of your screen or your notebook or typewriter or however you write, waiting for inspiration, doesn't actually work. You've just got to get on with it and be businesslike about it and start getting the words on the paper.
Were you doing creative writing at the same time as doing freelance writing?
I did a little bit, but then I dropped out because I was doing so much of the journalism. I was all written out. I was probably averaging a couple of thousand words a day on different articles and stories, and then sit down on an evening and write a bit more was just too much. So I did actually drop out of creative writing for the best part of about 30 years. I started doing it when I was at school, university, then sort of, you know, life gets in the way and it went on hold, and I then came back to it about 15 years ago.
And do you have a writing fuel of choice?
Fuel?
Yeah.
Or tool?
Fuel.
Fuel. Writing fuel. Fuel, yes. Green tea and dark chocolate.
Ah, very good. Tasty and a little bit healthy.
Yeah. Exactly. One of your five essential vegetables in the chocolate there.
Makes me wonder what the other four are.
More chocolate, baked beans, more chocolate, chips. Oh, tomato soup. That's another one. That's six, so I'm going well.
Excellent.
Is mayonnaise a vegetable? That's another one.
Excellent. Well, that's the green tea and the dark chocolate making up for the chips and mayonnaise and... and the baked beans. Okay, it sounds like we've got to know you a little bit more. So let's get a bit more in depth. So how do you describe your writing, and what themes do you like to explore?
I like to explore what I set out when I sort of restarted. I wanted to do urban fantasy. I rather like that mixture of the weird and the everyday, the fact that you go down a street and turn left one day instead of turning right and you find yourself in a goblin market or something that's just living there just out of sight of normal life. And that reflects in things like ghost stories, horror, the whole area. That's always intrigued me, and that, I suppose, is my favourite area, though I do like a straightforward conventional ghost story as well. In the M.R. Jamesy, slightly supernatural horror rather than just wafty sheet-like ghosts flitting around.
Good. So any themes that you like to explore as well?
Themes. I'm quite interested in time and how. I suppose it's like the. I'm trying to remember the name of the author. The Inspector Calls, the famous play, English writer of the 1930s. Oh, come back to me. But the type where just one thing changes and you head off in an entirely different direction. Well, I mean, the movie Sliding Doors was a good example of this, where just 1 or 2 minute changes here or there completely change the course of someone's life. I find that intriguing. What if you did that? What if that didn't happen? And not in the sort of what if Hitler got killed, would we have had the Second World War? That, not that level, which I think has been done to death, but on the more personal level. How one choice or one event can lead to an entirely different situation. You take a different direction and your entire life changes.
Is there anything from your own life that's made you want to explore that?
Not particularly, though as you get older, you do realise there were turning points in your life where you took a decision. And had you taken a different decision, things would have gone entirely differently and you wouldn't be the person you are now. But I think the bit people often miss is that it's not just one little thing that changes and so suddenly you're a millionaire. No, your entire life changes. It's not just, you pick a different number and you win the lottery. It's not. And you keep on your current life, but with the benefit of that one change. But rather, had you made that decision, your entire life would change. The people you dealt with and met would change. Your relationships would change. You wouldn't meet the people you are in relationships now. Everything would change. Mm-hmm. But I say, it's just as you get a bit older and sort of lying awake in the middle of the night, one of the delights of getting older, you sort of wake up with an adrenaline rush at 3 o'clock in the morning and relive parts of your life. But you realise that if I'd done that, or I had that opportunity there, but I turned it down. But, where would I be? And I did that once with a story, I think I've still got it lurking somewhere, waiting for me to finally finish. I'm a great prevaricator, where somebody makes one change and then they make, you know, their entire life changes, supposedly for the better from their existing life, but then they find themselves in the World Trade Center on 9/11. And then it all ends. And whereas if they hadn't done that, they might not have had an exciting time, but they would have had more time and not come to a fiery end. But I say it's just those little things like that.
Yeah, absolutely. So, in your writing,
J.B. Priest, J.B. Priestley. That's who I was trying to. Inspector Calls. I'm sure that's him. Yes, it's a play, but he explores that whole area of. Just one little change and the whole world is different, or the people, the characters, whole world is different.
Mm-hmm. Yep, absolutely. So
anyway,
getting back to the kind of key question that I like to ask, so what's the one thing that's been most helpful in improving your writing?
I think the key for me, because when I first got back into creative writing, I thought I'd try and jumpstart by attending various short and mid-termy courses at my local university, which happens to be the University of East Anglia, which is well known for its creative writing department and activities. And I think it was interesting, but I think the key point was a point where you thought it's time to stop going to do classes and do exercises, get out and start putting your own mark on the paper, get on and write your own stuff rather than just do courses. And I have seen people who just seem to be endlessly going from course to course. My wife is a painter now, and she went on a painting course and when she was exploring it, and the tutor there said, you know, there comes a point where you just there and start putting paint on the paper, and rather than learning about the techniques, but try it out in practice and start writing stuff and then reading it back and seeing whether it works. If you like, get out into the real world with your writing rather than the academic, isolated world.
Yeah, absolutely. And in your career as a journalist, what would have been the one thing that helped your writing there?
Journalism's slightly different, but basically meet the deadline, meet the number of words wanted, and stick to the brief. You soon discover that if somebody asks for 750 words, that's because they have a 750 word slot. They don't want 300 words because that leaves them a gap, and they don't want 1500 words because then they've got to edit it down. So it's surprising how many people don't get that, and they send you huge long essays. And you know, it's the who, why, what, where, when, and how situation. And get you know, meet the deadline, meet the lengths, and get to the brief. And again, practice is what does it. And you soon discover whether you're working or not, whether you get the work accepted or rejected. And with freelancing, it's only the work that gets accepted that gets paid, as opposed to if you're a staff journalist, where I recall there was a story about a journalist who worked for the Sunday Times for many years, Sunday Times in the UK, and apparently only ever 100 words published for one reason or another. All his stories were spiked and he was on the full-time salary. Just for one reason or another, shortage of space, not quite right, other stories coming along. Most of his work never saw the light of day. But say, when you're a freelance, that's not the issue. If you aren't getting it published, you're not getting paid.
Mm. Absolutely. Mm. So, are you trying anything new at the moment with your writing?
Yes, I am. I'm, as we sort of said in the warm up, I've finished two books recently and then read them through and thought, these are awful. They just don't do it. And if I can't be bothered to read it, then I can't expect the reader to. And so they've gone back in the drawer marked not to be looked at again for another 5 years. And then I'll, if I've got nothing better to do, have a look at doing them. One is 120,000 words, and I can't bear the thought of having to edit that again. It just needs recrafting. I suppose where I am is a realization that there's stuff I could write, and it would be a worthwhile product, but do I actually want to do it? Is it going to be fun? And I've sort of had to stop myself or abandon a number of projects halfway through because I thought, well, you know, it's more like back doing the freelancing. You know, we want 1,500 words by midday tomorrow on subject X. Can you do it? And I was, you know, well, I could write a book about marketing in the technology industry, and it would be jolly good. But I don't want to write that anymore. I want to write other stuff. So, I'm freeing my shackles, looking at other areas, and working on notes at the moment for getting back writing in the autumn. At the moment, we've got, bizarrely for the UK, wonderful weather. So I tend to be out running around the property, chopping trees down and trying to shoot rabbits that are digging up my lawn and doing things like that, like any normal person would do. and I'm pausing only for green tea and dark chocolate and so I'm not really quite in the writing zone at the moment. Looking to do something a little bit more experimentally short novella based on flash fiction-y incidents, that kind of thing. Mm. But I'm looking at that and having fun with it. I think I've done too much serious writing over the years, and it's time to have a bit of fun.
Yeah, it sounds a lot more fun than a book about marketing technology, that's for sure.
Exactly. Yes. I say that was my world for so long. How to write a press release and how not to write a press release.
Well, they sound very helpful, though.
Well, it is. It is. I've been on the receiving end of so many of them. And you read it, and I've read four pages and I still don't know what you're talking about. And that actually fits in with a lot of books I've read, sadly. You know, I've read four chapters and I still don't know.
So what writers inspire you then?
Well, I like, I've fished out some of the ones here that I've always had a soft spot for. I'm a big fan of Neil Gaiman, both his long works, short works. I prefer his short works, his fiction and his non-fiction. I suppose, he was a journalist as well, in the technology journalist in the early days. And that's how he got to meet. Oh, the brain is gone today. It was a long day yesterday. Terry Pratchett. That's how he got to meet Terry Pratchett, because Terry Pratchett was working in technology for Electricity Board, and they got they got meeting at talking at an event. But I love his stuff. He can some of it's not my taste, but he is just wonderful. I mean, the only problem I suppose I have with him, I read it and think, God, that is so good. I may as well give up now. I'm never going to be able to equal that. You know, not worth bothering. I'll go back and I'll give up and take up electric train sets as a hobby or something. Another writer I always enjoy, and it's one of those books that you can still read, is the late Douglas Adams of The Hitchhiker's Guide. And again, I think one of the things I like about him is his conversational side, because obviously The Hitchhiker's Guide originally began as radio plays, and so they are very much narrative driven rather than special effects and descriptions driven. And I have one of his comments on my wall. I love deadlines, whooshing sound they make as they go by. And I think that's a lesson for us all. There are deadlines, and then there are deadlines you can miss. It's one of the things I learned in journalism. You'd always be given a deadline, but then there was another deadline after that. And then actually there was another deadline after that that was a lot later. So there. But I like his stuff. I mentioned supernatural horror, M.R. James, his ghost stories. They, even though they were written in the Edwardian and first quarter of the 19th century, of the 20th century in England, they are still readable, being adapted. It's one of my little rituals. I read his books in December and scare myself bejesus reading them. Like his stuff. David Sedaris, Sedaris. His are short stories, but again very much narrative, and indeed he spends a lot of his time doing storytelling, traveling the world, giving his storytelling sessions, where basically he just sits there and his stories. It's a skill and an art. And I suppose actually the same with M.R. James, because all his stories were originally written with a view to him reading them out to an audience, rather than being written specifically for being published. And finally, Richard Brautigan, cult author from the 1960s, sadly deceased. One of those sort of late end of the couldn't publish enough work in the 60s and early 70s, and then suddenly fell from favor and went completely. He has lovely turns of phrases. I picked out a couple here. There's one is talking about an auctioneer talking very quickly at an auction. He said, "He had false teeth that sounded like crickets jumping up and down inside the jaws of a skeleton." I mean, it's a weird image, but it immediately gives that clack, clack, clack sound, and you know what he's talking about immediately. And, you know, there's another one here is describing a woman. "I'm in a coffee house, talk, who's wearing more clothes than I have money in the world. She is adorned in yellow and jewellery and a language I cannot understand." Again, it just sets up, you immediately get the image of somebody who is so outside your social circle, lifestyle and everything else. Just very, very economic with it. You know, his sentences are almost like haiku. And again, it's very much in a narrative. You could imagine him sitting next to you, telling you this story, and it would work. It's not one that you need to submerse yourself in with large descriptive passages and so on. I say it's narration. It's the narrative driving it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Good. So you've also written a book about writing tips of your own, so writing genre fiction. So if you were to pick one or two tips, what would you like to share from what you've put together?
Oh, right. I suppose I would say the book is on genre fiction, and I suppose one of the things I've noticed, because I have done a bit of script doctoring with people, sent me manuscripts or a critique and so on, and I suppose the things I notice is particularly with science fiction that people get carried away with the gadgets at the expense of everything else. Mm. And you have to care about the protagonist. You have to care about them. If you're reading a book and frankly you couldn't care whether they live or die, it doesn't matter how clever your descriptions of interspace travel are. You've lost your audience. They're not going to be with you, and you've got to have the people there. You've got to keep people on. You've got to keep your reader on board. They've got to have empathy for the characters. Ditto the villains, particularly in science fiction, the villains are often very one-dimensional, and you think, well, why are they like that? Why are they doing that? Once again, people just don't suddenly emerge and cackling manically, they're Dr. Evil. They've got a backstory. What's the backstory? How did they get to it? And if you have a bit of sympathy and understanding for it, then it's it's a better job. It's a bit like Milton's Paradise Lost. There's a huge backstory to Lucifer in there, and he actually comes across as a nicer guy than God, possibly going too far in the extreme. But you do need to have that, because otherwise it's just cardboard cutouts. I mean, yes, sure, it might make a movie if you're into movies that involve lots of people hitting each other and crashes and bashes and special effects. But in a book, it's rather different, and you've got to keep your audience on board and have a character development. Not have character developments where suddenly they change just because they're driven by the exigencies of the plot. Woman is. Now I'm trying to think of one. Well, there's quite a common one where, the woman is kidnapped by the villain and treated badly, but falls in love with him. And you think, well, no, this, we know about Stockholm syndrome and things like that. But, that's just implausible. You wouldn't do it. She'd be traumatized by the treatment she's got. She's not going to fall in love with you, or somebody develops a trait that you haven't seen before. Where one of the characters was a complete wimp who suddenly turns into a master criminal, and you think, well, there would have been indications, that's just a big jump too far. You've got to have a consistency. You've got to, it's the suspension of disbelief. And yes, if you're talking science fiction, the whole thing is disbelief, because we are dealing with pure fiction on things that don't exist and indeed may never exist. But you've still got to have an element of consistency, and you can't just make your people jump through strange character traits just to keep the plot going.
Yeah, you can.
I mean, one thing that always... Sorry, you say...
Yeah. Your character has to change, but not absolutely completely about face kind of change.
Yeah, exactly. You mean you've got to have a sort of character development arc, and along with your story arc and everything, that the character starts here and ends there and learns lessons or evolves or does something in the process, but not to the extent that defies psychology, psychiatry, human in everything else. It's a bit like when you see some of the soap operas on TV, and in the course of 1 year, things happen to people that don't happen to most people in their entire lives. And if they did, just one single element would probably leave them traumatized with post-traumatic shock disorder for years and taking treatment and counseling. But no, you know, just get over it. Oh, my wife was murdered. Oh, well, 2 weeks later, they're doing something else and they've just moved on, you know. Yeah, that's fine for television, for soaps, but it doesn't when it jumps like that. You just sort of, this is implausible. You know, as I say, you've got to suspend disbelief, but you've still got to have an element of consistency, and it can't be just completely implausible behavior. I suppose that's it, that people get carried away with the gadgets and the technology, and if it's a history, their historical research. You know, I know exactly how a knight of armor was put together or whatever, but they forget the human part, and it's just rather clunky people in clunky relationships with dialogue, and you don't care about it. Mm. Yeah, it's like there was a play based on I'm bad on names this morning. No, I'll have to skip that one. It'll probably come to me later as soon as we go. Yep, no, gone. Yeah. Scrub that.
All right. So it's I'll give you a chance to get back to your other 50 hats that you're wearing. So I'll start to wrap up now. So if people are interested in finding out more about all your different hats, your werewolf hunting, your podcasts, your fiction, where's the best place to find you online?
The best place is on my website, www.urbanfantasist. F-A-N-T-A-S-I-S-T fantasist.com, and that's got links to everything. And as you know, I'm also active on Twitter at Christian Uncut, and I spend probably far too much time on there as well, but those are the best places to find me, and they have anything else from there.
Absolutely. All right.
And obviously my my books are available on Amazon.
Of course. Excellent. All right. Well, thank you so much for your time today, Charles. That was really fun.
Good. I totally enjoyed doing that. And look forward to speaking to you again.
Thanks for listening to Right Through the Roof. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe or spread the word by writing a review on your listening platform of choice. And if you'd like to get in contact with me, please go to madelinedeist.com or madeline_deist on Twitter, no apostrophes. You can find the show notes for this episode on madelinedeist.com under the Right Through the Roof tab. And until next time, what are you going to do to improve your writing this week?